Welcome to Sonic Artifacts. This week on our interview series, we're heading over to Poole, England to speak with Elliot Trent of Trent Guitars. Building out of a historic port town off the southern coast, Trent Guitars offers a very cool line of instruments and even hardware, with sustainability as the main focus. This is your host, Brian Chalemi, signing in from Manhattan. And Elliot, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Cool, thank you for having me. You've done your research.
Yes, sir. I've been cruising on your website, man. And you do talk a lot about sustainability and the materials and the chemicals and everything that you use to build these really, really cool guitars. So why don't we just open up with how you got started and why that's your philosophy and how deep that goes?
So I don't have the musician origin story that a lot of people have. I picked up guitar as a young, you know, like 10 or 11 years old, but I never really took to it. But the one thing I always have taken to is making things. So I have this fascination with, I've always had it with, instead of purchasing things, I would sooner try and make it myself. And it's got pretty out of hand now, where I have some quite useless machinery, but I haven't been able to make a couple of interesting things, but essentially I got back into guitar during COVID. At the time, I had been making furniture I'd been a fine furniture maker, whatever you want to call it, for about 10 years. By that time, I'd worked a lot in people's houses, installing, you know, all kinds of furniture. But I was getting to the point where I wanted to have something that was product based, so I could just kind of be a hermit away in my workshop and play with tools all the time, rather than, you know, going to visit people and discussing what they're looking for and then making it and then installing it. And then, yeah, I kind of got a bit bored of, I don't know, being trying to fulfill other people's visions. So I tried to kind of adopt this, you know, workshop based existence. So couple that with COVID, I was able to then take my rediscovered interest in guitar and be like, well, why would I buy a guitar when a guitar is pretty much just a bizarre shaped piece of furniture? So through 2020, I started, you know, initially I just pulled a guitar I had apart, just to really understand what was going on inside it. And then beyond that, it was, you know, a bit of teaching myself how to do these, the process is to fill in what I already knew from the process of taking wood and making it smaller. The key skills you need with making electric guitars essentially is the ability to sand and finish wood. I was able to then pick it up quite quickly because obviously I already had those skills and I just needed to fill in the other stuff and develop my own guitar. I had a good friend of mine who was more of a musician. He had more he played out a bit more, and he was able to kind of be my sounding board for like working out what might be nice to have in a guitar, what might be comfortable. And then what I brought to it was my kind of mid-century aesthetic that came from the furniture I like to make. The focus on, you know, clean lines, very unadorned, like kind of like the antithesis to a flame maple top is kind of what mine are. They are very simple, and kind of the approach is almost trying to be what the Telecaster initially was, which is a tool, the guitar that I want to have, that people want to have still kicking around in, you know, for a lifetime. So so sustainability in design, so again coming from the mid-century bent, is really important to me, because just the idea of having a design that is timeless but then also incorporating sustainable materials and sustainable production methods. So it kind of all came together at the right time, and I got pretty lucky with hitting it off early on, and I haven't been able to keep up since. So I guess that is a rough idea of how I got here.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I love reducing carpentry to just, it's the art of making the wood smaller. Like, I think is what you said.
I got that off another podcast I listened to years ago. I think their byline was taking wood and making it smaller. It's just silly.
Well, you know, I could definitely see the mid-century influence in the guitars. I mean, they're super, like you said, streamlined, but you do offer a variety of finishes, sparkle, different color tops and everything like that. So it's got a really cool, funky vibe to them if you want to go there, or pretty plain colors if you want. It sounds like it's definitely, like you said, striking lines through with, some sort of like a Mustang kind of feel, offset body, but you're definitely doing your own thing with that. How hard was it to come up with your own designs? Because obviously there's so many different builders out there now.
Yeah, so starting out, I definitely wanted to do an offset, just because the shape of a Jazzmaster, Mustang, and Jaguar, of course, always really spoke to me. I have to be honest, I wasn't, before I got really into the building world, I wasn't particularly well versed in Tysco or like kind of more far out brands. But when I was looking for inspiration, it was the St. Vincent from Music Man. I love the shape of that. And then the Mariposa and the Albert Lee. So they're three shapes from Music Man that use definitely more striking lines to them, rather than complete organic kind of like flow that you would see on a Fender. One thing you'll notice is there's not a straight line on them. It flows beautifully through, but I kind of wanted to have kind of a slightly bolder silhouette. And then to go on from there, I then went down the more boutique looking kind of route, and I looked at brands like McMull and Novo, and they're doing something really interesting. So I was picking things from that other people were doing, because that is how you come up with something that is gonna be timeless. It was a lot of experimenting in the evenings after work, because I was still full time doing my own thing, making furniture. So I think at the time I was doing a cafe, building some like bespoke seating for a cafe. And so in the evenings I would be in a CAD program, and I would, because I knew SketchUp from the furniture stuff, because clients would always want to see a rough idea. And there's one thing to see it on the screen, but then there's another thing to actually print it out and cut it out of a piece of MDF. So where I've got the luxury of having a workshop, a full woodworking workshop, I would do the whole, you can do like print in as like a poster. So you could print like one-to-one from SketchUp or from a PDF. And I print in A4 because, and who has a printer these days? And then stick them together, cut them out, and then transfer it onto a sheet of wood. And then you do all this work and you'd be like, oh, that looks great on the computer. And then you would have the silhouette in front of you. You'd be like, no, that's wrong. And then you'd have to go through again, tweak this, tweak that. And then it got to the stage where it was quicker to kind of do a kind of freeform drawing. But yeah, it was for the body shape, it took, for the Model 1, because that's the main guitar I sell, it took maybe 3 to 4 months of just like wherever I could squeeze it in, whilst also building, like I built probably like 30 or 40 necks just to like really get my head around it. But yeah, all those evenings just getting these outlines out of a SketchUp and transferring them onto wood, and then just seeing how it felt, if it felt right. And I remember I'd have it, I'm in my home studio, and I remember having one hung up on the wall just to see if it looked right. And I just remember being like, nah, it needs, because it needs to look, because in my head, I'm like, it needs to look good vertical as well as horizontal. So like, so I'm just there like, oh, like sorting the small stuff. And then also it has to fit into a hard case. So it's, yeah, it was a lot of taking parts from different designs and kind of mashing them together. But somehow it seemed to have, all I seem to get is praise for the shape. So I got there in the end, I think.
Yeah, definitely, man. I mean, that's the whole battle, especially coming not as a guitar player, one, how it sounds. I mean, Leo Fender didn't play guitar either, so nothing against that. And, you know, but also, like you said, the depth of the off brands and like what's really out there. Going back to the sustainability, you know, you use only water-based finishes and sustainably harvest timber. Can you talk about that and the sourcing and the philosophy behind that?
Yes. Yeah, so early on, so coming from, again, furniture making, I would make, you know, plywood kitchens or like you know, cabinetry, and they would typically have a lacquered carcass and then painted doors. So I actually developed my spray finishing about 5 or 6 years ago. So I luckily, by chance, I already had a complete spray setup. And this spray setup is completely water-based, because the idea is, it's not so much of an issue in the States, because you guys don't have the same kind of expectation of, you guys are used to solvent-based products. But here, if you went into somebody's house and installed a freshly painted door that stank of you know, spirits, or they'd be like, why does this still, you know, smell like white spirit in here or mineral spirits? So early on, I had to switch over to water-based. Well, no, I had to begin in water-based because it was better for the customer. So then fast forward to guitars. When I first started out, there was definitely a few people doing it, but very much only people kind of my size. And it still is the case. You might have some people doing water-based, which is base coat, which is your color coat. That's what they call it in the car world. But they'll always do a nitro or a polyurethane top coat. But I wanted to come at it with, try and go with as much water-based as possible, because yeah, it does still, it's not like you still shouldn't pour it down the drain, but it's a lot better base. It's a lot better to have water as the base than a solvent, so for the environment. So I figured, if I'll do the best I can with what I have. And so what that led to was a load of experimenting, because I don't want to get too technical, because it's a bit boring, but water-based paints build up in a different way to something like nitrocellulose. To put it plainly, nitrocellulose, you can build it coat on coat, and it will almost then melt into itself and become one big coat, and which makes it incredibly easy to work with, incredibly easy to prepare. And yeah, but the thing with water-based, it's always layers, so it's coats. So I had to learn how to build these coats in a way that, one, wasn't making them really thick and like, which I didn't want to do, like with polyurethane, and also wasn't full of imperfections. So I kind of managed to strike a balance with the open pore finish, which is far and away the most popular that I do, which is where you can see the pores of the timber, because that is simply color on bare wood, and it's like 3 or 4 coats, and that's it. It's what you would call a close to the wood finish, so you can feel it and it still feels like wood. But then when people want a gloss, that's where it becomes more interesting, because I have to then grain fill and then build up the base and then spray the top coat perfectly. And then with water base, you have to sand between each coat. So it just becomes this like kind of nightmare of keeping it clean. So what I did with the glosses, I've moved to what's called a light worn-in gloss. So it allows me to kind of not have a completely sterile setup and not have like a huge amount of film thickness, to build a gloss, but I still have that really nice tactile feeling of the water base. So with the worn-in, it's not like a relic. It's more like an old guitar. So I essentially spray it up and then basically rub it all back with a fine sandpaper. And it turns it into this much more tactile feeling kind of old thing, but still has a bit of shine to it. But yeah, that's the paint. With the timber, it's sustainable in that it's sourced from plantation. So it'll be sourced from, it's not sourced from, like, you know, rainforests or places like that. So there's countries who have crops of the main body timber, like a beechy. And then everything else it's all sourced through the chain of custody. So it will tell you where it comes from. Sustainability of timber isn't quite so much a thing that I go on about too much, because most timber is relatively sustainable just due to its a lot of the industry runs carbon positive because of how they offset it. It's important to obviously look where the materials come from. That's why I have that. I don't know if you saw on the website, but I have the I call it the M1R, so it's the M1 reclaimed. So I do a model that uses entirely reclaimed materials.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not all sustainable. You have actually an incredibly interesting source of wood for one of your guitars here.
Yeah. So that is it's funny, because I've had two or three people message me and ask if it's radioactive, and it's not. So we had a nuclear research reactor in Dorset, which is the county that I'm in, or you guys would call them states. At this facility, they had an apprentice school where they would teach these guys how to work on how to fix these and maintain these reactors. And in that school, they had these mahogany workbenches, which is actual Honduran mahogany from the 50s. And yeah, I found a local source that he has a stack of it. It really is lovely stuff. It's really lightweight. It's nice to give it kind of a new life again, because it's just sat up basically in somebody's garage.
So these were like the workbenches at the nuclear research?
At the training college for it that was on the site.
Gotcha.
So in the mid-century, after the Second World War, we were in a rush to catch up with America with development of nuclear energy and other things. And they built this, it's in a place called Winfrith, and they built this test reactor, but then they'd also built this apprenticeship school where these guys could go and learn how to be electricians for the plant or plumbers or this, that, and the other. But yeah, that's where they came from.
How did you come across this wood?
So there's a local, I don't know what you'd call him. He's I guess it's a sawmill, but he gets like odd bits of timber and saws it up. And we have quite a big culture in the UK of farmers will chop up big like oak logs or and then basically shred everything else. So you will have these people who kind of save logs from these guys and mill them up and sell them. And it can be a bit of a minefield, because with making instruments, you really want timber that's been correctly dried. And a lot of the time, if you buy timber off a guy from a farm, he's just stacked it and left it for a couple of years. So the good thing with the Winfrith stuff, with the workbench, with the Honduran mahogany from that, is it's quite clearly very well seasoned and in incredibly it's been around for a long time. It hasn't just fallen down in a storm a few years ago.
Well, it's a beautiful model. Is it semi-hollow?
Yeah. That one is, yeah. Because initially I was like, oh, I have to make it chambered or you know, like a thin line, because I'm not using a beechy, and a beechy is incredibly light. So I wanted to maintain, because I essentially want all my guitars to be basically 7 pounds or less. because I just had, because I do actually play guitar, just not very well.
Okay.
But whenever I pick up a guitar, I seem to always pick up the lightest one. So I kind of transition that into my guitars. And I was I made that like a key. Initially, when I launched them, I was making the bodies out of poplar, and surprisingly heavy compared to something like a Beachy there's a Japanese timber that is also incredibly light. So yeah, my reasoning for going semi-hollow was because I'm like, oh, this is going to be too heavy for me. This is going to be like an 8-pound guitar, but it wouldn't have been because the Honduran mahogany is so light. It's very different to like, because a lot of people substitute mahogany with sapele, and that is a heavier timber, not as heavy as some, but yeah, you kind of get in the weeds with this kind of stuff because it is mostly about feel. So
right, I mean, 7 pounds is pretty solid, man. I mean, no one's gonna tell you that's like too light or too heavy.
Yeah, it seems to be like the Goldilocks. I've made one as light as 5.5, I think, but that I can't remember. I think that was one of the early thin lines. But I've made a few of the semi hollow now, and I've kind of refined how I do it, and it looks lovely on the inside. It's really quite a lot of wood removed. I almost do it so it's like a center block, basically.
Very cool, man. And even the fingerboard is from a local marina.
Yeah, so that's a timber called Red Bilau, which is common timber. I can't remember what region it comes from, but it in the Victorian period, we were bringing a lot of timber back from our colonies to make like jetties and like piers and like in general like high strength tropical timber. We were bringing back from our colonies. So the town I grew up in is actually a so I grew up in the town over from here, but that's like a proper Victorian tourist town. So it has a lot of stuff built in it from these bizarre tropical timbers, like all the groins, which are those structures that go out to the water on a beach. They're all made out of tropical hardwood from the turn of the century. And just because it's, you know, it's high in silica, it's really, really durable. And we bought a lot of our water structures out of it. So I imagine this came from a similar kind of source. I cut off probably a 2-meter section of it just to set what I needed. But the beam itself was huge. It was a massive beam, completely like distorted from being so long, but obviously I'm only using bits that are, you know, 500 600 mil long, so about 2 foot long. So
I mean, that's super cool. I mean, again, sourcing this old wood to build, you know, the guitar, a guitar like this locally. I mean, you are like a beach town, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah. And I went proper down the rabbit hole on that one. They've got even like used tuners off Reverb and like wooden pickup covers I made them out of maple offcuts from the necks and then ebonized them with like an India ink to make them black. So yeah, that was a fun one.
That's very cool, man. And I do say your pricing that's on the website, you know, is very reasonable for what you're offering here. You know, just a heads up to everyone out there. I know you have a 6 to 12 month lead time, but you know, this is all handmade, and you are the only person that's doing any of this, correct?
Yeah. I did do a brief flirtation with. I had a trusted and close luthier friend. He did 10 necks. 10 fret jobs, not neck. I made the necks and loaded them up in this amazing like ammo case I made for them. It was so cool. And I posted them off to him, and he did 10 fret jobs for me because I was trying to kind of move things through the workshop a bit faster, and they were perfect, but the time saving wasn't there. So I've it's just me doing everything. I'm kind of a bit obsessive with managing everything myself. It would be nice to have some help, but anyone who runs a business in in probably the EU as well as the UK, it's incredibly expensive to hire people. And you kind of need somebody who's just like you, and that's difficult.
Your twin brother.
Well, I do have a twin brother. But
oh, wow, you do?
Yeah, bizarrely. But
got to get him involved.
Yeah, he's got his own thing going.
I didn't go that far in the research, man. I didn't know that, really.
Didn't go on Facebook, yeah.
No. Man, that's, well, I mean, you know, again, people out there, you're getting something that's every step of the way is, you know, is built by one person's vision here. And you have a very clear vision, you know, like you said, drawn from the furniture, mid-century design. And going into the other models, you know, you do your own custom P90s, and they all come with P90s. Why did you choose P90s specifically, and what is different about your P90?
So with P90s, so again, Coming into it, I might not be a like seasoned guitarist, but I know what I like the sound of through music. So it was a case of working through with my good friend that what I kind of wanted to get from them. So initially I started out not making the P90s. They were made by Bare Knuckle. And I got about, I think, 20 or 30 guitars in, and I was like looking at these pickups, and I was like, you know, like I'm spending a lot of money on these. Like there's not much to them. So I was looking at them, and I got in touch with Josh at Righteous Sound Pickups, who is a very well-known pickup maker in America. He used to work for Lola. Now he does his own stuff. And He's famous for his set that he makes called the Gazing set. So I've put the Gazing set into like probably 8 or 9 of my builds. People just constantly ask me. It's either him or McNally people want in when they're not made by me. So yeah, I got in touch with Josh, and he was so nice. I literally said to him, I can remember it really clearly. I said, would it be unreasonable for me to make my own pickup, to make my own P90s? And he said, not at all. It would be completely reasonable. Like, they are the ideal pickup to start with. And he basically said, buy this, buy that, buy blah, buy whatever. I cobbled together a winding machine that I'd made, because again, I just want to make everything. I just bought like a hall sensor and like a magnet, so just to count the turns, and then mounted it onto a the motor was, I think it, people always say it's from a sewing machine, but I think this actually was a sewing machine motor. I managed to kind of cobble together this thing to wind up a coil and just kind of get my head around it, get my head what it feels like, and yeah, I love doing it. I always say this to people, out of everything that I do for the guitars, the one thing is the main thing that I'm so glad I did was switch to one of my pickups, because it's not particularly difficult to start with, and you can, not to disparage anyone who does this, just makes pickups for a living, but with certain areas like P90s, it is quite simple just to get a sound from one and to get there. And essentially what Josh so kindly did was give me loads of tips on how to feel it, how to, you know, the technical aspect of it, like what it feels like when you're getting the tension right, and what it you know, and how much you should wax pot it versus not wax potting it, and that was one of the biggest things was the wax potting. I only pot them for a very short period, and for literally 60 seconds, and I got a load of them. I got like probably 6 or 7 P90s and potted them all at different intervals, and they all sounded completely different. It was super bizarre. I even at one stage I was convinced that like, that's because I, you know, they're all different coils. So I took a P90, wound it, and then recorded it, and then potted it, recorded it again, and then potted it some more. And sorry, potting is when you immerse a pickup coil in wax. It gives you a little bit less noise from the coil, essentially. Anyway, So I found that the more they potted, the more they were potted, they started to sound really woolly and really like kind of how you would expect something to sound if you smothered it in wax. So I got to the stage where I found my happy place of the 60 seconds. And then from there, I was able to then consistently wind the same coil with the same tension. Like you can squeeze the winds and you can feel how much is in it. And you can feel like it's almost like a springiness to it. And just being able to take that process back and be like, yeah, I'm going to do this. And they sounded good. And I'm really surprised. I've had probably 10 customers then buy sets after to put them in their other guitars. And I'm just like, that's just crazy. I can't believe, like, I'm just like kind of a novice at this. But, you know, having now wound probably, well, yeah, I've probably wound 300 P90s now. I can do it quite well. But yeah, it was thanks to the generosity of Josh that really got my confidence up. And then since then, I've just applied the same principle to winding, you know, Jaguar pickups and Strat pickups and Telecaster pickups. And I haven't cracked humbuckers yet. I very rarely do them. And if I do, people are looking for a really specific sound. So they will tell me, I want a House of Tone, whatever in it, or I want a Lola, something or another. And I've done a lot of the Stagger Swaggers by McNelly. And yeah, so kind of, I haven't really touched humbuckers yet, but single coils, I'm just an absolute joy to wind. And then now I'm getting to the stage where I do clear bobbins with slug coils on P90s, and they just sound wicked. Like, I'll do them on Special Quest.
So did you have like a song reference that you were like, oh, this is a P90, this is what I want my guitars to sound like?
Oh, specifically, I don't know. It probably wasn't specific music. It was more, I like the sound of something that has, it sounds really silly, but it's clean, but not. So not, I'm not talking like Edge of Breakup. Like that's like the classic, like, you know, the sound that is very, it always sounds good. I'm talking more, it has the clarity of a single coil, but then more mid presence. So not too trebly, and not, it won't have the airiness. I really find that the P90 is the ultimate compromise in a pickup in all the best ways. Especially, obviously, if you're in a situation where you can't control noise, any single coil can, of course, be pretty difficult to deal with. But most people, single coils are never going to be a problem when it comes to noise. So, yeah, I guess I just wanted something not too boomy and not muddy, but still really clear, which I think is what you get from them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic pickup, super cool. It's one of the few pickups that I actually don't own, and I look forward to getting into them in the future.
Oh, you have to.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love the sound of Les Paul Juniors and, you know, yep, that whole thing. And I've seen some debates online whether to use a 250 or 500K pot. You use 500?
500, yeah. Yeah, I got that off Josh, yeah.
Okay.
So cool. Essentially, how's the easiest way I can put this? I might get it wrong. But the way I understand it is 500 will allow you to cut more brightness. So 500 will give you a brighter starting point, which is why you run 250s on a Strat, because they're already bright enough to begin with. That's as far as I can remember. But I've just found 500 just to be, it kind of works for everything. I've done the one meg thing with when I've wound Jazz Masters, and I find it's definitely something to experiment with, but for P90s, yeah, 500 is just the way for me, because they're not bright, they're not overly bright as it is, so it's having that extra brightness you get from a 500K pot isn't gonna isn't going to cause you too much trouble.
That's interesting. The Jazzmaster is 1 meg, because I know the wide range, traditional wide ranges are 1 meg as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure. The Jazzmasters are in 1 meg. People will run them at 250 though. Like it just totally depends what. I think even Shelley over at Black Bobbin, I think he is an advocate for 250. He's done something with Lola, so they've done so essentially there's never any hard and fast rule to anything. You've just got to try it, and then you know it's very easy to get hung up on rules. You get it a lot with making things as well, where people are like, oh, you have to do it this way or that way, but the kind of the old British attitude of we've always been like, oh, we'll just make it work with whatever tools we have. And that's kind of my favorite approach to everything.
You have done that, and you've taken things around you, like I said, you know, eco-friendly, less carbon footprint on all your materials, on the way you build here. And you do offer a 30-inch scale bass as well. Do you do those bass pickups as too?
Yeah. Those are wicked. They are. I got Josh's advice when I was winding them, because it's a Mustang pickup, so a Mustang bass pickup. Those are two tiny coils, and each of them have 13,000 winds of 42 gauge wire on it. And it's like, I've really got to be on my A game, because the way you attach it to the winder, because I bought a better winder since using my DIY one, and the way I attach it to the winder is nearly always with double-sided tape. If the bond isn't quite there, I'll sometimes have a tiny little bobbin fly across the room. I just love the sound, the Mustang sound. It's the basses have done surprisingly well for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very cool looking bass, man. I mean, if anyone looking for a short scale, and the offer, you know, it's 30-inch scale for the bass, but all your guitars, I noticed, you offer varying neck lengths and scales as people prefer, which is super cool.
Yeah, so it's tricky, because I didn't want to go down the route of... I'm not a custom guitar builder, so I'm not. Someone can't come to me and be like, "Build me a Strat," because I don't do that. But I want to offer as much options as I can. But I have had the experience of people not being able to pick because there's too many options. So with colors, I'm offering essentially nearly 2,000 colors. But the way that I've combated that is I invite people to learn from the coolness of other people. So I pretty much say, go on my Instagram and just send me the pictures of the ones you like, and I can do it again, basically. Because I've done, I think 50% of my guitars that I've made, because I've made about 100 now, 50% of them are custom colors. Either I do a match for them with like a Fender color, or they've said, I want this exact color. And so yeah, the color has been good, but yeah, when people start to get in the whole paralysis by analysis stage, I just tend to kind of tell them what I think's cool. And then with the scale lengths and radiuses, I think it's more of a strength than a stumbling block, because people who know what they want, it's there. So, but for example, only people who want 7.25 inches on the radius pick that, because it's very specific. You don't accidentally pick that. So, but I've got down the middle, I've got, well, I would say the standard offering of this would, you know, what feels kind of in the middling, even though it's not the middle, would probably be 12. Like, because if you've come from playing a range of instruments, you've got a neutral kind of ground. 12 kind of covers everything. I think it's the one thing that I would say I prefer in a Gibson over a Fender. I just think 25.5 I prefer over 24.75, but 12. So essentially, for the people who want the choice, it's there. And for the people who want to know what I would pick or what other people would pick, I just have brackets standard against, like, so the standard would be like a 24, 25.5, 12-inch radius. I think it works out in the end. it's just sometimes it can be a bit of a hamstring where people are like, oh, there's so many options. But I reply to emails, so.
Yeah, I mean, your website is not like an endless list of options either. It's pretty clear. It's a very, like, you know, streamlined website, so it's not like super confusing or anything.
Yeah, that's the hope, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously, when you go on your website, you have a whole section for hardware. So this is something that a lot of builders do not do. So I would love for you to go into what you offer in terms of hardware. And as well as I see you've done some collaborations with, you know, Chris Swope of Swope Guitars, whom we've had on the show. Great guy.
Yeah, he's a legend, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd love to hear about all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so when I started out, I was offering just a hardtail. And then within like a month after getting a million emails, I offered the Jazzmaster vibrato. So that from the beginning, I've offered Descendant vibratos and bridges. And then for a more cost efficient option, I offered the Hosco is a Japanese company. They essentially make affordable versions of you know, normal hardware that you find on any guitar. So that was cool for about a year. And then the first step I made into hardware was I saw Chris had done a really cool little hardtail that he was calling the Blue Collar Bridge, I think. And he still sells it. And I essentially said to him, how would you feel if I made my own version of this? And he was just mega legend. We had a pretty good relationship already. Obviously, we're not pals, but we have long chats about the industry and stuff because he's so experienced. And he kindly just said, well, you know, I don't have any design, you know, design ownership over a bent plate. So for all intents and purposes, do what you want. And so I made one. To get them made, it's a small piece of bent steel. And on the face of it, it's like, oh, that's easy. But to get a sheet of steel bent perfectly and then with the holes and all the right spacing, it's not very trivial. You have like distortion and all this and the other. So luckily in Poole, where I am, we're actually big on precision engineering. There is a lot of people who make stuff for aerospace here, a lot of people who make stuff for oil and gas industry. And historically, Poole has been very much an industrial area after it was the port town. So I go down to a local place near me, which is probably a mile from my workshop. They're a sheet metal company. They do all sorts of strange parts. But in this room, they've got a laser cutter that is just the size of a room. And you can literally put a sheet of stainless steel on one side and then parts come out the other end. So I did all the technical drawings. Because by now I'd picked up a lot of experience in CAD. And with this bent plate, I had 50 made, and I got the neck plates and the control plates done at the same time, all in brushed stainless steel. And yeah, I dumped a load of money into it and then got this box of parts, and it was magic. And to have like, it was relatively easy to get like sorted. And I don't know if it was a unique experience, but everyone was so easy to deal with. It only took about a month, and it was all done round the corner. And initially, I just put on my brass saddles that I bought from, I think they're Wilkinson. And again, following a year from that, I was like, no, I'm going to make my own saddles. So I designed these saddles, and then did them up in CAD, and then had them machined by another engineer. And they CNC machined those. Beautiful, look amazing. Got my own saddles on my own hardtail. And I thought, well, the only thing that's left to do now is to essentially deconstruct the vibrato and bridge and kind of make my own take on it. And the vibrato, unlike Chris's, which is an improvement on the on the original design. Mine's more of just a modern manufactured version of Leo's original design. So it's, again, all made by the same company in Paul, who do all the bending and the lasering. And then I do the engraving and obviously the assembling. They just give me a pile of parts. They're like, what even is this we're making? And I'm like, it's all fine. Like, it all works. And I just do a lot of secondary processing on it. So I run it through my milling machine where I true up the pivot to make it dead sharp. And essentially what I'm trying to do is do the best version of Leo's design I can do. I'm not trying to add any additional functionality. And then I make a lot of the small parts on the lathe myself. So like for the bridges, I make the bridge posts. So I turn them up on my lathe. And then I make all the smaller bits of hardware, basically. And the trem arms I make and single point thread on my lathe. And yeah, this obsession that I spoke about at the beginning of with kind of making everything I can myself is just, this is just it completely manifested. I'm at the stage now where ideally I'd like to move to doing all my pit guard material myself, but obviously I don't want to get into like plastic casting, but I'm talking like laminating onto, you know, the backs of plexi or perspex, as we call it here. And yeah, bits and bobs. I'm always looking at new things to do. The journey of doing my own hardware, you have to be really into it. But if you are like me, yeah, it's no problem at all.
Well, you sound like you're in the right place with the right head for the whole thing here.
Yeah, I have a very understanding partner as well. My girlfriend really puts up with me.
You talk a lot about the bridge to her.
it's more just spending all the time at the workshop.
Like, gotcha.
7 days a week. Like, I kind of need to learn to the work-life balance better.
Well, I mean, that's having your own business, you know, the freedom of working 7 days a week.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and apparently we also pay no tax. Oh yeah, really? Somebody tell the tax man that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I pay way more tax than I'd like, but yeah.
What, so where's your workshop?
It's just down the road it's a industrial unit on a we call them industrial estates here. I'm not sure what they're called over there, but they're like steel portal buildings basically. That I lease from a landlord who owns probably about 20 of them, so.
What's the greatest moment so far? I mean, like I said, you had a pretty quick rise here in terms of notability.
Yeah, so it kind of went from like one strength to the next. So I launched it in the business in, I think it was June 2021. And then it was very slow to begin with, and as it would be. And then I'd had one to Guitar Magazine, which was one of the biggest publications here. They've now gone to online only. But and I think I was in the last paper issue. I had my review that came out in December of 21. So Richard Purvis at Guitar did a review. And he awarded it 9 out of 10, and Chris, the editor, gave it the editor's choice. And then that came out December, and that kind of bubbled over Christmas. And then in January, I got like 15 orders, which like from like nothing to that was crazy. And I was able just to, ever since then, I haven't done anything else other than this. And so that was a huge moment. But then being able to approach, one of my favorite artists, which is Jessica Dobson of, Deep Sea Diver, a giant fan of her work, like from way before making guitars. And after lots of It's crazy. Anyone who's done artist outreach knows it's quite difficult because they have a lot of spam and you kind of have to try and get through. And I think it took me about 6 months of like trying over and over again of like emailing and then Instagram. And then I got the bright idea to email her management, which probably if I was a bit more intelligent, I would have done that first. But I emailed her management and then her management emailed her. And then the moment she emailed me back, oh my God, I was just floored. She was super stoked. She was like, oh my God, I love your work, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh my God, like kind of like, you know, like speaking to like one of my favorite musicians and like not really knowing how to handle it because it's very surreal. And then to be able to make her one, and then now she's recorded a load of their new record with it, which is coming out. It's just unreal. And then I was like, well, yeah, that's kind of the peak. Like I've got one to like one of my favorites. And then Jessica, I always wanted to get one to Madison. So that's Madison Cunningham. And because again, massive fan. Maddie went up to see Jessica by chance. And I'd been trying again to get hold of Madison for like 6 months. And this was like proving impossible. I couldn't get through anywhere. And I said, I messaged Jessica saying, please ask her to send me a message. And then thankfully she did and made the communication there and then got one to Madison. And that was just something else. And that was like, she's probably my favorite guitar player. I don't know. Jessica is as well though. So it's kind of, the double act of like the guitar heroes. And yeah, that was just incredible. And then the most outrageous one by far is Wet Leg, which is how I know Ruben. That came from, I was launching the bass. And I wanted one to go to a really interesting band. And my friends all put me onto Wet Leg, listened to their music, absolutely loved it. It's, to me, it's like the pure essence of like guitar music. Like it's just loud amps, loud guitar, just great riffs and like great vocals. And so I was like, yeah, this is going to be amazing. So I contacted the bassist and he put me in touch with, so that's Ellis. He put me in touch with their touring tech called Dave Larkin, who's just a mega legend. And we had then had a chat, got a bass made, got a bass out to them. And then, and this was like 2 weeks before Glastonbury. And then I turn on bloody BBC, the coverage of Glastonbury, and there's Ellis playing the bass on the stage at Glastonbury, and I'm like, well, that's something. And yeah, that was pretty mind-blowing.
That's awesome, man. I mean, going from, not only do you get to do the thing you love and be your own boss and have your own business, but then you get to, you know, inspire and provide instruments to people that you love in terms of, you know, music and seeing these things on TV and hearing them on records. Just such a wonderful cycle of a thing.
It's crazy. And it's of course one of the reasons we do it. Like any, you ask any maker, like there's definitely a level of ego to it in a perfectly healthy way of like, I did that, like, and like, oh my God, they're playing something I made. Like, that's just crazy. And then realizing that, like, you know, they're kind of getting to express themselves through something you've done. It's just so thoroughly rewarding. And then, yeah. And then I had the pleasure of making a guitar for Hester from Wet Leg, which then they went and supported Harry Styles with and played at Wembley and stadiums all over the world. It was just utterly surreal. And I can't thank Dave enough, the guitar tech for kind of facilitating everything. He's been an absolute legend.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, shout out to Ruben at Ruby Guitars who, you know, connected us. Obviously both have guitar, well, like as both of your guitars here.
Yeah, on the stage of the Brit Award.
Yeah, very cool, wild. Man. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, especially like, you know, going from building furniture, it's one thing to see someone sitting in a chair. It's another thing to see them playing an instrument that's making music and sonic sound waves and affecting people emotionally. I mean, that's a whole other level.
Yeah, it's kind of unreal. It's like, well, the reason I got into making things, it was very much for that level of permanence that you can give to somebody with, you know, making them a bed that they'll have for years and years, or, you know, a dining table that they feed their kids on. It always had that sense of joy with it. But yeah, the instrument is kind of the next level. It's their, like, when it can become like their inspiration. And when people say things like, I'm so glad I bought this because it's made me want to pick up playing guitar again. It's just all you can ask for, really.
That's awesome, man. Thank you again for coming on the show.
Cool. No worries. Thanks for having me.
Definitely, man. Anything you want to leave the listeners off with?
Support small businesses.
There you go, man. Everyone, check out the website. Check out the Instagram. We'll have links up. Trent Guitars at a pool in the UK.
And that concludes this week's edition of our interview series here at Sonic Artifacts. Remember to please hit the subscribe button on your favorite streaming platform and lend support over at Patreon. This is your host, Brian Chalemi, signing off from Manhattan, and we'll see you guys next time.